which numbers to start?
Verse 12. Om Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Vaitamrita Varshini Bhagavatim Ashadashadhyayinim Ambatvamana Santadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Verse 12. Shreyo Jnanam Abhyasat Shreyo Jnanam Abhyasat Jnanat Jnanam Vishishyate Jnanat Jnanam Vishishyate Jnanat Karma Palatyagaha Jnanat Karma Palatyagaha Jagat Shantim Manantaram Jagat Shantim Anantaram Shreyaha Hi Jnanam Abhyasat Jnanat Jnanam Vishishyate Jnanat Karma Palatyagaha Karma Palatyagaha Tyagat Shantihi Anantaram. After going through all of these different levels, if you're not able to do that, then you can do this. But if you're not able to do that, then you can do this. And in the end, in ending with karma palatyaga, if you can't do any of those things, then do your actions and accept the results as prasad, with that prasad de buddhi, you know, as a gift from Bhagavan, as prasad from Bhagavan. So now, up into this point, it looks like this Sarvakarma Palatyaga. Tyaga means that renunciation of all the karma polas. It means as keeping your kartritvam, and in fact in the karma yoga you're keeping your kartritvam, there's that sense of doership is still there. You haven't recognized aham brahmasmi, you haven't recognized that yet. You have shraddha in it, but you haven't recognized it. So with that karma yoga buddhi, he's gone through all of these different levels, and in the end, he says, if you can't do any of those things, even the very last one, he says, then do the tyaga. Give up all of the results of your actions. You go ahead and do the actions with your raga dvesha. I want this, I need this, this is what I want to do. But we always receive the results of the actions as with that prasada buddhi. Testing? Okay. So that makes it sound like this karmapala tyaga, giving up the karmapala, is kind of for all the losers. All the ones who can't, you can't manage this, okay. We can't manage this, that's okay, okay. We're left with this one. This one I'm sure you can manage. Okay. So now what he says, he goes through the order in a different way, because if you remember the question here, Arjuna's question is, you know, what is the best, quickest way, you know, the most efficacious way to moksha, to liberation? What is the best path? He thinks initially, you know, is it taking sannyasa? Or is it karma yoga? What is it? What will get me there the quickest? In Shankara, what Krishna does is he doesn't accept the question. He looks at the sannyasa and he says, the sannyasa, that sannyasa buddhi is for the one who is already understood or so close to understanding. All the antakarana shuddhi is there. The raga dvesha has been neutralized. All that mind requires now is to sit shravana manana nididhyasana and to do that. Shravana manana nididhyasana, basically. Nididhyasana means the contemplation. Shravana is, just to recap this in a few seconds, few minutes. Shravana, this is the sadhana. If one has antakarana shuddhi, the sadhana, the direct means of knowledge for moksha is shravana manana nididhyasana. If the antakarana shuddhi is there, It's called Upanishta. Upanishta is, what do I do to gain moksha? What is the direct cause of moksha? Right? What is the direct cause? And that is Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. But that's assuming that the mind, which is the instrument that needs to gain this knowledge, right, has the qualifications to gain it. Right? And that is called Upayanishta. So if we look at the sadhanas are twofold. Upayanishta, Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. That is the direct means of knowledge. Right? Antakarna Shuddhi, to bring about the Upayanishta, the sadhanas meant to bring about the Antakarna Shuddhi, that purity of mind that allows this knowledge to take place, that can even receive this knowledge. Okay, so these are the two sadhanas that are there. One is direct, the other is indirect. You see what I mean? The one is indirect in the sense that if you can have Antakarna Shuddhi and be an Ajnani. You know, you have a relatively quiet mind, but the mumukshutvam is still there because knowledge hasn't taken place. But your mind is ripe for it. So when Arjuna asks his question, he's saying, what I believe is that I should just go run off to the woods, you know, and do Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. But Krishna says, no, you should do Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, this Upayanishta, this sadhana for gaining the knowledge, but you shouldn't isolate yourself from the world in such a way that you can't neutralize your raga dvesha. And so you still need to, that neutralization of raga dvesha, of likes and dislikes, still needs to take place. Right? And so what he does is he says, so we're not going to talk about sannyasa, you know, taking the orange and going off to the forest. We're not going to talk about that. We want to talk about the karma yoga, which can give the antakarna shuddhi that can result in this knowledge, that can prepare the mind for this knowledge. Right? And so he leaves the sannyasa behind. Because for him, the sannyasa, that sannyasa buddhi, you know, is dependent upon the karma yoga buddhi. Right? And so now he says, he leaves that alone. He says, so we're going to look at karma yoga. What is the best? And he says, what is the best is the karma yoga buddhi plus upasana. And what he means by that is, if my mind already has a degree of antakarna shuddhi, it already has some neutralization of likes and dislikes, to the extent that I can spend my time in contemplation. And remember, I'm doing Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. I am a mumukshu. I don't have this knowledge yet. I am gaining this knowledge. Right? I am in the process of gaining this knowledge through Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. Shravana, Manana, and Nididhyasana is the same for both. And so now I'm doing the Shravana. I'm listening to understanding what the Upanishads are saying. I'm exposing myself to the Pramana, to this vision. I am questioning it once I understand. Once I understand, I'm exposing myself to the Pramana, and then I'm all Pramana means the whole teaching methodology. And then as I do that, I gain clarity on what the Upanishads are saying. I start to see it and gain some clarity. But then doubts are coming in two forms. The doubts, for one form, is in reference to the Pramana itself. It's saying, is this what the Upanishad is saying? You know? What did the Upanishad actually say? Is it saying this or is it saying that? That's Shravana. A getting clarity around what the Upanishad, what the vision is. Manana is a different type of doubt, a different type of questioning. It's, the Upanishad is saying this, I understand. But why couldn't it be like this? It could also be this way. The Upanishad says this, but it could be this way. So all of the different study of all of the different darshanas and now the modern day darshanas come in to analyze them and negate them, actually. You know, if you can't negate them, then they're probably saying the same thing as the Vedanta is saying. Right? Otherwise, they're going to be within the realm of Dvaita. They're going to be within the realm of duality, and you can, if they are within the realm of duality, they're easily negatable. In fact, I think in the Kena Upanishad, they use the example of, or Swamiji has gone off on one of the, in his unfoldment of the verses. They're negatable just like blowing away a straw, because the logic can't hold up. So, but who's to say? You have to, because when you come with a doubt, you're serious about it, right? And that doubt needs to be dealt with. And so the manana is dealing with all of these doubts which are questioning the veracity of the pramana itself, of the Upanishad itself. Shravana is understanding the Upanishad. Manana is questioning, why can't it be a different way? Nididhyasana, so Shravana and manana is taking place as the teaching unfolds. It's the job of the teacher to be doing the Shravana and the manana. And the Nididhyasana also takes place at the time of teaching, and it takes place on your own too. So Nididhyasana, the job of the Nididhyasana is to break the Dehatma Buddhi, to neutralize the Dehatma Buddhi. Dehatma Buddhi means that conviction that I am the Atma, the body is the Atma, that Anyonya Adhyasa, because even as you get knowledge, your mind continues to behave as though you don't have it, right? Just So now, this Shravana Manana Nididhyasana is something that continues ongoing for both sannyasi and karma yogi, because both are mumukshus, right? So being a mumukshu, this knowledge is a given, but this knowledge has taken place. But for the sannyasi has already resolved the raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes. So Shankara starts with, puts aside the sannyasi and looks at karma yoga for the one who's likes and dislikes are now, at this point in their life, not much of a problem. For them, it is easy to perform all of their karmas. All of the karmas that you do are for Ishwar. Because here you have a body, you have the prarabdha karma, you have duties and responsibilities. So all of those duties and responsibilities you perform with that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. You take it, you bow down to Bhagavan, and you do your duties. That's what you do. And you do Saguna Brahma Upasana. Means that you spend your free time contemplating on Ishwara. Contemplating on Ishwara means I still have the Kartrutvam. There's still Beda there. There's still duality there. I'm exposing myself to the teaching. I know, according to the teaching, I am Brahman. But I haven't realized it yet. I know it indirectly as it's being unfolded to me. I have Shraddha, and so I've heard the words of the teacher, but it hasn't clicked yet. I haven't seen it yet. And so I continue to do Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, and at the same time worshipping and doing Upasana, Saguna Brahma Upasana on Ishwara. So that just strengthens my mind, so that everything I do when I'm not doing the Upasana, everything I do then, I've strengthened my mind to seeing all of this as Ishwara, and then all of my actions are an Ishwara Arpana Buddhi in devotion to Bhagavan, to Ishwara. The whole creation is Ishwara. And I'm perfectly happy spending my time just doing my duties for the sake of Antakarana Shuddhi, for the sake of gaining this knowledge. That's what I do. So So Krishna says, that is the best. And that's the fastest, because, I mean, actually, your raga dveshas are very much neutralized already, and you're in a position to do that, you know, and you're now, your whole behavior is so close to that of a jnani, because Ishwara, everything is Ishwara, and everything I do is a worship of Ishwara. Then he says, okay, if you're not able to do the Saguna Brahma Upasana, you know, then do Abhyasa. Means use the yoga, you know, the yama, the niyama, the yogas, do asana, pranayama, all of these things in order to strengthen your mind, to be able to focus your mind on the Saguna Brahma Upasana. To meditate on Brahman if your mind is wandering, do the abhyasa to make your mind steady. And then continuing to do the karma yoga, seeing everything as Ishwara, do also this abhyasa, this repetition, you know, the especially the Patanjali Yoga, you know, up through the pranayama and dhyana, the dharana, being able to focus the mind. You do that, you know, and then that Saguna Brahma Upasana will become more available to you. But, you know, if you find that you, even the abhyasa doesn't work, you can't, your mind is too distracted, then you just forget the abhyasa, forget the Saguna Brahma Upasana, and you just do do all of your actions, all of the actions as a worship for Ishvara, to Ishvara. And so there again, the raga dvesha, not too bad, but you know, your mind is, doesn't have this, what we call antakarna naschalya. It just is, it's rajasic. It doesn't have the ability to just stay still. So that doesn't matter. You just do all of your actions as devotion to Ishvara. You just follow your dharma, you know. Forget the raga, let the raga dveshas go. You just concentrate on doing your duty. That's it. But if you have still a lot of raga dvesha, there's a lot of desire. There are things I still, even in spite of my shravana, there's still things that I want to accomplish within dharma. I don't want to accomplish them adharmically, but there's still things in my life I want to fulfill, I want to accomplish. Then, okay, if that's the case, then you do those actions within dharma, you do them dharmically, but you go after those things and you accept the results of those actions. You know, you as coming from me, tyaga means you give up the results of the action. You give them up how? You give them to Bhagavan. Because actually, no matter what karmas you do, you know, you don't have control. You can do the karma. You have some control over the karma. You have no control over the action, over the result. You think you do, but you can find out repeatedly that you don't. Sometimes what it works out how you want it to, and many times it doesn't work out how you want it to. So you take the results of the action, of your actions, with that prasada buddhi. Okay? Now, if you do that, so here we are kind of at the end of the list. He doesn't have any after this, but there's nothing else left after this. But the thing is that in each one of these, all the way through, what you get is shanti. Because even with the karma, the tyaga, the renouncing, handing over to Bhagavan, accepting as that prasada buddhi, that itself gives shanti. I can pursue my karmas. I can pursue my prarabdha. I can pursue my desires, accepting the results as Bhagavan. And if I can do that, again, I have the same shanti. Okay? And so now, just to make sure, now, after having said this in kind of this gradiated way, to make sure that you really, really understand what that means, what the karmapala, you know, the karmapala tyaga, that renounce, how that actually gives the same pala as all of the others. It gives the same pala, gives the same fruit. The fruit is the shanti, which is necessary to gain this knowledge. So now he says, in this one, he says here, in fact, Shankara says in his little introduction to this verse, he says, idanim sarva karma palatyagam stauti. Idanim means now. He praises, stauti means he praises. Krishna is himself praising this final one. He's now praising sarva karma palatyaga. He's now praising that what that means, that he's praising, in a sense, putting it first in a way, you know, that the giving up of the fruits of your karma, you know, how powerful that is. So it goes like this. He says, Shreyaha hi jnanam abhyasat. Shreyas means better. You know, it's a comparative, sure, or better. Here we use it as better, shreyas. It is Shreyas. What is Shreyas? Jnanam is better than Abhyasa. So here what is meant is this. By Jnanam, what he means, because we're not talking now about self-knowledge. This whole Karma Yoga, the whole Karma Yoga differentiation is for the Ajnani, the Mumukshu who does not yet have self-knowledge. So here what does Jnanam mean is that Viveka, the one who is, has what we call is clear, has clarity about their Purushartha. This word Purushartha, there's four Purusharthas. Artha, Kama, Dharma, and Moksha. Purushartha means, what do human beings pursue? What do they want in life? That's a Purushartha. What are the human goals? The first one, if we put it in this order, is artha. I want security. I want enough food. I want a roof over my head. I want to feel some security. I want enough money in the bank. If I have this security, roof over my head, some food, some job security, I have all kinds of things that are just about security. That's artha. But if I have the artha, then after that, that's established, then I want kama. If I don't have any artha, I'm not going to care about kama. Kama means the things that for my enjoyment, the things that I would love to do, that are fun, that give me pleasure, Then I can start, getting these things, I can get my new iPhone. I can collect these things or have these experiences, that are pleasurable. But they don't have to do with security, really. The security I need, so I can feel safe. But then once I have that, I have enough food, etc., then I can collect these things and do these pleasurable things. That's kama. So now, artha and kama, these two go for all beings, really, all human beings. Dharma, when dharma and moksha, then religion comes in. At least the way we look at this in Hinduism. Dharma is, I follow the laws of Bhagavan. I follow in India it would be, I follow the Vedas. I do the dharma that is taught to me in the Sanatana Dharma of the Vedas. I follow that religiously.
Is it
Dharma? Dharma. Dharma.
I thought
it was Dharma. No, Dharma. I follow Dharma so that I won't accrue papa and I will accrue punya. Because if I accrue, I want the punya so that I can get a better next birth. And also that I can go to higher lokas in between. So I want to improve my lot, and I want to have Bhagavan's grace so that I can get a better next birth and at least as good as the one I have now. So I take that very seriously. For a Hindu, dharma is a serious thing because this birth is only one of many. And so your behavior and your following of the Vedic prescriptions and all this is very important. You don't want to accrue punya. You don't want to be born, as a hyena or something. you want to have a better birth. So there's a certain religious values and shraddha come in when we bring in dharma. And the last one, Purushartha, is moksha. And so moksha means I would already have the dharma. But for a mumukshu, it's the one who has recognized none of these, artha, kama, dharma, can give me what I really seek, which is that wholeness, that fullness, that completeness that isn't subject to change. A resolution with Bhagavan, that I, for an Indian, so I can recognize myself as whole and complete. So I can say, kritya-kritya, everything which is to be, which is to be done, that has been done. It's finished. I'm full, I'm complete. That's moksha. But that desire for moksha requires that the limitations of artha and kama and dharma has been recognized. Dharma, I can say I do my dharma and I'm doing the rituals and upasanas and all proper behavior so that I can get to swargaloka. But a mamuksha will say, you'll get to swargaloka, but you have to come back. You know? And so anything that you achieve, as pleasurable as it may be, you have to come back. And so here what is meant by jnanam is that there is clarity around these purusharthas. There is viveka. So the nitya, what we call nitya anitya vastu viveka, means I have recognized, I have that viveka. Go ahead. No, sorry, I was coughing myself. I didn't want to interrupt you. Okay, that viveka. You know, in the viveka vairagya? Viveka, with viveka, which is one of the first qualities for a mumukshu, is called nitya anitya vastu viveka. I have discrimination. I've discriminated between nitya and anitya. I'll say, I don't know what is nitya. I don't know what is timeless. Nitya means timeless. But I know that everything I know is anitya, time-bound. I know that. And if I know that all experience is anitya, is time-bound, I know that I can't achieve anything lasting here within duality. It's not possible. And so that means that every experience I have is what we call a dukkha yoni. Every experience is a dukkha yoni. Any sukha, put specifically, any sukha, any happy experience is a womb for dukkha. It's a womb for dukkha because all experience comes to an end. Right? So you're either in dukkha, you're either having dukkha, or you're in the dukkha yoni state. Because all experience comes to an end. It is not as though it will remain. And so that will, if it's something dear to you or something that you love, right? It's a dukkha yoni. It's giving birth to dukkha as it comes to an end, right? And so the mumukshu has recognized that, and that recognition has led to vairagya. Vairagya means these things are not what I'm seeking. They're fine, but they don't give me what I'm seeking in my heart. That's why a mumukshu will more and more recognize, as you have experiences of joy, you also very much recognize the sadness underneath it. The sadness of your recognition of its finitude. You know, and you don't even really have to be a mumukshu for it. Anybody will recognize that. You know, you're having tremendous joy over something that will come to an end, and the mind knows that. At some point, the mind realizes that there's no exceptions to that fact. You know? And so becomes a mumukshu. So when he says jnanam is greater than abhyasa, and we'll talk about that in a minute, he means that purushartha jnanam, you've recognized the limitations of the other three purusharthas and you are seeking moksha. Right? Because you have this nitya anitya vastu viveka. Means you have discrimination over the vastu is the things that are here. There's a nitya vastu is Brahman. That vastu which is timeless is Brahman. Everything else is anitya, time bound. So the purushartha for you is very clear. So in this case, he says, that jnanam, purushartha jnanam, is superior to abhyasa. Abhyasa, now remember, abhyasa without that jnanam is simply the practice of the values, yama, niyama. It's the practice. It's the practice of the asanas. There's no jnanam there. There's no purushartha jnanam. I'm just doing the asanas. The asanas make me feel better. Definitely. They're very powerful. These yoga asanas are wonderful. Pranayama is wonderful for the amount of shanti it gives the mind. Right? It gives so much shanti to the mind. The body becomes so comfortable. You feel so balanced. And you can practice dharana, you can practice centered meditation, but there's no purushartha jnanam. And so you have a gain, but the gain is for what? Well, it could be so that I can feel physically comfortable. Or it can be a gain, so, you know, my mind is agitated, let me practice pranayama. I can teach that as a therapist. I can teach it. You go do some asanas, do some pranayama. It'll help you. It'll help your body, help you psychologically. You'll feel better. Oh, your mind is very agitated. Let's practice some dharma. Do these things. They will help you. And they will help you. But there's no viveka. And so that, as helpful as it is, the purushartha jnanam is more helpful. So he says, in terms of gaining moksha, the abhyasa is good, the ashtanga yoga, very good, but the purushartha jnanam is better. And then he says, better than that jnanam, okay, better than that jnanam, that purushartha jnanam, he goes, jnanat jnanam vishishyate, jnanam is better. Okay? So now we have to look at it like this. Jnanam is better than the jnanam. You have to realize that we're building up something here. We look at it like this. Abhyasa is good. It's very helpful for having a peaceful mind and a balanced body, you know, feeling good about yourself in the world, feeling physiologically and psychologically centered. It is good. But if you have that and jnanam, you have that, but jnanam is better, it's closer. But you have the abhyasa, and now you have the jnanam, purushartha jnanam. You've got these two. But now if you have jnanam also, that is better. Okay? So now you have the jnanam, right? And the jnanam includes the karma yoga. Okay? Because now we're going to the first tier. So if you have the karma yoga, which includes, you have the jnanam, which includes the karma yoga, then that is better. Okay? You have the purushartha, you're practicing the karma yoga, right? You're practicing karma yoga, you're doing the upasana, giving everything to Ishwara, but then he says, better than that jnana is the karma polityaga. Because he says, meaning giving up the results of all action. Because if that tyaga, all these other things are there, and you give up also the results of all action, the tyaga. Tyaga means renunciation. Renunciation means what? You give it all to Bhagavan. And Swamiji in his commentary says, what's so nice about this is you give it to Bhagavan, but then Bhagavan already has it anyway, so nothing really happens. It's like if I said, you know, oh, I love my Harry Potter cup, you know. So let me renounce it, let me give it to you. But then you'll take it away. But if I offer it to Bhagavan, you know, nothing, he won't take it. But mentally, I've given all that up. So if mentally I've given it up, whatever that may be, then my heart is free. You know, because everything I receive, I receive it as prasad. You know, this prasad to buddhi is such a wonderful thing for those of you who have been to temple, but you go to the temple and you receive prasad from Bhagavan. Every ritual, you know, every time we do a puja, the pujari will always give prasad. You know, I've told the story before, but just quickly, you know, the prasad can be anything from a huge banquet-like meal on a banana leaf, you know, to water. You know, just simple few drops of water. So there's a huge range in the prasad. It could also be some flower leaves like rose petals, you know, or just some chandan. It can be many things, or it can be food, you know, a little container of food, all kinds of things it can be. Or just vibhuti, ash it can be. It just depends on the temple and the day and what happens to be the prasad that's available. But the devotee, why this is so powerful, especially for a Hindu, for a devotee, is it doesn't matter what the prasad is. It doesn't matter at all. It is prasad, you know. And so you would never say, oh, I don't want that prasad, I want this other one. Mm-hmm. That won't happen in Indian heart, it won't happen, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul, one of our friends, you know, Swamiji was going on about this, and Paul, this one of our friends, he said, "Yeah, but Swamiji, I might have wanted. I think I might want it to be different." You know, Swamiji laughed. But in India, it won't happen. That won't happen. That prasada buddhi, you know, is if it's water, you would never drop the water on the ground. You would take the water and you'd touch your eyes, you know, and maybe rub it through your head. The chandan you would put, you know, the rose petal you would put behind your ear. All of it is always protected. It's always cherished. And in that prasada, so that prasada buddhi in reference to your life, it's like saying, whatever comes to me, even though I may be seeking this or going after this or going after that or going after that, whatever comes to me, I take as prasad. And so it's the ultimate, really, because I am able and free to go about my way in the world, whatever desires are there, you know, to fulfill them as long as they're within Dharma. You know, if they're without and not within Dharma, then you have to use your discipline. If you recognize this as an adharmic act, then you need some viveka. Say, do I want to do a dharma for this? This is a whole different question. But the prasada buddhi means let me pursue my life, whatever is there, but always everything that I receive is from Ishvara. And then that is so rich because there's also so many, you give Bhagavan the benefit of the doubt also. Like this moment is perfect for me. This is what I need. This is what I need at this moment. And that's a beautiful sadhana. So you accept these moments and these challenges because, you know, life's so challenging. It's very challenging. It's because of our raga dvesha, really. You know? So it's so challenging. But with that karma yoga, that karma polityaga, there's a different, totally different relationship you have with the world. And what he says is that, he says, from dhyana, that dhyana in karma yoga, actually, this karma polityagaha, this is better. You know? He's, why? Because tyagat, he says, from that tyaga, now he just says, from the tyaga, from that renunciation, you know, accepting everything is it from Ishvara, he says, there is shantihi anantaram. Why is it shantihi? You know, it takes you, anantaram means it's the supreme shanti. It really takes you to the other side of samsara. It takes you to the other side of samsara. Because for you, you know, there's nothing to disturb your shanti. What's to disturb it? And so now when you have that shantavritti, now that mind is really ready. And when I say ready, it's really available for this knowledge. Now, that's not to say, this is important because people think, okay, then I should just do karma yoga. And then when everything seems just perfect in my mind, I'm mature in my karma yoga, then I can listen. Do shravana manana nididhyasana. That's not so. The shravana manana nididhyasana helps the karma yoga. Okay? The karma yoga helps the shravana manana nididhyasana. And so both are happening simultaneously. Both support and feed each other. You know? So how to help my mind, you know, get rid of or drop off these raga dveshas. You know, that we all come to this knowledge with raga dvesha. Because why wouldn't we? Only the jnani is going to be the one for whom raga dvesha, these likes and dislikes, are mitya. Not a samsari. A person who doesn't have knowledge, you can't tell that person, you know, you don't really need to be happy. You know? The person has, okay, if I could just, and this is real, it's not mitya. For a samsari, for an ajnani, there is no mitya. You know? There is no recognition that the nature of of your being is the very ananda that you seek. That is not there. And so now you tell this person, it's all right for you not to have any ananda. You know? This thing that you want so badly, you know, that you're not getting. The thing is, and you want this, I ask, why do you want this thing? I really need this. If I need this to be like this in order for me to be whole, to be complete, to be full, you know. And I'll say, oh, that's all right, give it up anyway. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
It's all just words, it's just blabber.
Mm.
It doesn't mean anything. Mm. Without knowledge, without kind of ongoing recognition of the very source of the wholeness that you seek as being your own being, and understanding that there's so much logic to be able to really, it's not just seeing it, it's also supported by so much logic, by so much experience. As this teaching unfolds, that knowledge supports everything about this karma yoga buddhi and saguna brahma upasana and giving up the results of your action to accepting this from Bhagavan. All of it is supported by your knowledge, you know. So you're gaining nishta in your knowledge, and you're having behaving in the world in a way that supports that knowledge, right? And the knowledge supports the karma yoga supports the knowledge, and it's a nice combination. Remember, the thing is, there's two nishtas, upaya nishta and upaya nishta, right? Upaya nishta is how to calm my mind down. It's lived from beginningless time in ajnana, from beginningless time. It has done its best within duality to become happy. You know? And that's all it knows. Okay? So how to rein the mind, all of those vasanas, all of those ways of being, how to neutralize all of that? Karma yoga. Okay? And Saguna Brahman brings about that nice chalya, that steadiness of mind. So, and then, what is the knowledge? Upaya nishtha. So, exposing myself to this teaching so that I can see, and see from this way, and see from this way, and see from this way. You can't just have a teacher come, you know, the great Vedantin is coming, and you're sitting before the teacher who says, you are Brahman, you are infinite, you are Satchit-Ananda. You are the very ananda that you seek. Go and be happy. Go and be happy. You are all full and complete and whole. Be happy. That is your very nature. 10 minutes, you're liberated. Yeah. It doesn't do anything. You know, you can, if they're nice words, and they can calm your mind, but so can drugs. So can anything. It's not enough. You know? It's not enough. So there has to be the Upanishad. That's not an Upanishad. That's not the Vedanta. That's not the whole Sampradaya of teaching. The whole teaching Sampradaya, it has so many teaching methodologies, so many things to see, so many things for the mind to understand. So the mind knows, you know? It knows not only, there's not only the pramana working to through lakshana, through pointing, to make you recognize your own being. All of the questions of the mind, having recognized that, you know, but why? What about this and what about that? And who am I in this whole creation? And who is Ishvara? What is this whole creation? Who is God? What am I? What is this jiva? What is this? Who is this person? What happens to the jiva? All of these questions are valid. These are legitimate questions for the mind. So let the mind have all of these questions. And then in the light of this vision, what is the answer to these questions? Why shouldn't they be answered? And so that Shravana Manana Nididhyasana doesn't take place in an hour. It doesn't take place in 10 minutes. It takes place over a prolonged period of time. You know, so that the, until the mind itself is satisfied. And nobody can tell you that your mind is satisfied. Like say you ask questions, and you've been asking questions for a couple of years now, and then I say, okay, that's good.
You made it.
Yeah, you've asked the 100th question. Now it's good. It's not like that. You're the one who knows when that clarity is there. And that when the clarity is there, you have recognized this yourself. You have a question. You ask a say in the light of this knowledge or their satsang or something, and you ask a question. You know, and the teacher does his or her best to answer that question. But no, that's not quite it. You know, it's still, that question is still there. It might be a little more clear, but the question is still there. There comes a time when the question is no longer there. And that time is when the buddhi is satisfied with that answer. And so then what will happen is that if the question were to come again, it comes along with the answer. And then after a time, there's because the answer is there. The answer is not some rote memorization. It means that on a deep level, your buddhi has seen it, has understood it. And so not only you see it, experience supports it, and logic supports it. So we say, for there to be clarity, or for there to be knowledge, there's three things involved. One is the pramana. Here the pramana is the shruti, the Upanishad. But the pramana, the means of knowledge, has to be there. That means of knowledge, the shruti, has to be supported and not in conflict with your anubhava, with your experience. You may not have seen it this way before, but now the experience that is there supports what you now see. It doesn't negate it. And the other thing is yukti. Yukti is it's logical. It can withstand any amount of logical analysis. This is what we mean by knowledge. And so the pramana is there, the anubhava, the experience is there, and the logic is there, the yukti. And then the mind is that okay? Or I get it. In the tenth man's story, one very important part of that story is when the old man asked the boy to count out the other nine. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. These nine, and then the old man says 10. Okay? What these nine represent are all of the doubts. Okay? It could be this. It could be this. It could, and you say, no, it's not that. No, it's not that. No, it's not that. No, it's not that. Those doubts are one by one resolved. And as those doubts are resolved, then the tenth man, you are the tenth man, makes sense. Say if I just, he starts out, just hypothetically, the old sadhu starts out, the tenth man feels the tenth man is drowned or whatever has happened to it. He says, oh, don't bother, you're the tenth man. You're the tenth man. Immediately he'll get, I'm not the tenth man. 1, 2, 3. See what I mean? And he'll say, I'll show you I'm not the tenth man. And he gives his whole string of logics. So after all of those strings of logic have been done, then when the old sadhu says, you're the tenth man, it's an awakening. Because there's nowhere else for his mind to go. So that's why, in fact, in the teaching methodology, that's why these darshanas, the manana, is so important. Everybody has their, why can't it be this way? That's a legitimate question. Why can't it be this way? Well, say if you ask the teacher, why can't it be this way? And the teacher says, how could you ask that? Don't you have shraddha in what the Upanishad says? The Upanishad says this. Yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? Don't ask those things. Just accept what the Upanishad says. You see what I mean? And that's not okay. Not in just the Vedanta. In India, it's not okay. This Purvapaksha Siddhanta, the Purvapaksha means, Tamanana. I ask the teacher, or whoever, a question. Why can't it be like this? The teacher has to respond to that and say, it can't be like this because of blah, blah, blah. Now, the blah, blah, blah isn't, the answer is not because the Shruti says it's like this. That is not the answer. The Shruti, you already know the Shruti says it's like this. And so the answer has to be on the very terms of the questioner. So for instance, say, if there's a Sankhya yogin asks, you know, why can't there be many Purushas? Because in Sankhya they believe there are many Purushas. And each Purusha is that Chidananda is infinite and pure conscious being. But there are an infinite number of them. And so that person is listening to Advaita to the teacher, unfolding that there is only one Brahman, only one soul. So that Sankhya is going to say, no, why can't there be many Purushas? And say, I answer, there can't be many Purushas because the Upanishad says there is only one. That is not an answer. The answer has to be in reference to the questioner and their reality. Within your darshana, you say this, and that can't be so because you can't bring in what the Upanishad says. See what I mean? You have to answer those doubts. You have to negate the veracity of the belief on the terms of the belief itself. See? And so if that isn't done, then that belief stands. There are two beliefs. Okay, I believe this, you believe this. There's nothing is resolved. See what I mean? You believe this, and I say, you can't believe that because this is what the Shruti says. Well, I don't accept what the Shruti says. I like what the Sankhya says. So you have your belief, I have my belief. This isn't about belief. This is about jnanam. And so jnanam means there has to be a pramana. It has to withstand any amount of logic. And it has to withstand your experience. All of it. And when it does that, then your mind says, okay. Your mind sees it clearly. And there's nothing in the buddhi that can negate it. And so the buddhi bows down to that jnana. You bow down to knowledge. You don't bow down to somebody's belief. You bow down to not the buddhi, not you, the buddhi bows down. It resolves. The question resolves into knowledge. So. All of this karma yoga creates a mind that's available to revel in this knowledge. It creates a strong container because the raga dveshas have been neutralized. The raga dveshas are not an issue for you. But you're doing the shravana mana dhyasana, and the raga dvesha have resolved into Ishvara, into Dharma. And so the mind enjoys the shanti, and that mind can go ahead and take sannyasa if it's a lifestyle that you want to live. You'd be a sannyasi anyway. Whether you take the orange or not, doesn't really make any difference. Yeah. That mind is a hair's breadth, from deep understanding. It doesn't make any difference once you know, and the raga dveshas are resolved. You already are a sannyasi by guna. It's called guna sannyasa. And you're a sannyasi whether you're wearing orange or not. You're a sannyasi because you know yourself, and there's nothing in your mind that's needs to be handled in terms of your knowledge. And so, you can, if you like to wear the orange because that's just your prarabdha and it suits your lifestyle and everything, then you can actually take the sannyasa. If it's something that doesn't suit your lifestyle, doesn't work, then you don't take it. But either person's a sannyasi. Jnani is a sannyasi. That's what it is. So. Now the next, to the end of the chapter, all of the next verses, see how many are there? So from 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, or there's several verses. All of them are talking about the mind of the jnani, the mind and heart of the jnani. What if I were to describe, so Krishna says, this is what a jnani's mind is like. This is how they feel, you know, toward the world when these raga dveshas are resolved. So it's very beautiful. In fact, these verses, just like this verses in chapter 13 that will do this for us also, these verses become our values. For jnani, they're just natural. As you have nishta, these characteristics are just natural to you. But to the degree that they're not natural, they become your sadhana, your values. You may not act that way, but that's your value. Okay? So they're the values that are exemplars for our mind and our behavior. So very beautiful, you'll see. Okay, that's what I'm going to do today. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
It kind of gets brought about by the resolution of raga and dvesha.
It's like the neutralization of raga and dvesha.
And how else do you kind of, what builds up to antakana shuddhi, that the person actually presents it as a quality of that the buddhi is in that state of antakana shuddhi? What leads up to that? What's the
I think it's the combination of, well, I mean, even without knowledge, the following of Dharma itself is neutral, just that, even for a samsari, following Dharma neutralizes raga dvesha. Because if you're following Dharma, the things that, the ragas that you may have that go along with that Dharma, we don't even call them as ragas, because there's no conflict. And so if the practice of Dharma always trumps raga dvesha, and Dharma itself, when it's trumping raga dvesha, that itself brings about ashanti. Okay. And so now when you add to that, there's for the mumukshu, there's the shravana manana nididhyasana taking place. Then there's the recognition that really Dharma is Ishvara. Ishwar is Dharma. Dharma is the order of the just Ishwar's order. And so in the following of Dharma, your behavior, what you are doing, is in harmony with Ishwar. The jiva has free will, right? And so you can go against that natural order, which is kind of like banging your head against a wall. You know, it's not comfortable. It brings about a lot of stress and a lot of tension.
What do you mean, go against the order?
Go, Ishwara's order. Say if you say the order is ahimsa. The order is the golden rule.
Mm.
You know? And when you go against that, there's a price to be paid. Right? You're able, the creation will allow you to go against that natural order. The natural order that is saying, you know, say your arm, this is my own just example at the moment, okay, your arm, you know, can go this way, that's the natural order, okay? This is not the actual natural order to go the other way. If you try to go too much against the natural order, you'll be in a great deal of pain. It's meant to go like this, you know? Human beings, what is natural to you as a human being? When the raga dvesha are not in the way, you know, is empathy, is compassion, is kindness, is helping, you know, your nature is one of wholeness, of goodness. The human being is basically good. What screws it up is this raga dvesha, right? It goes against what is natural to you, and it is uncomfortable. And it's not only uncomfortable for you, it's uncomfortable for others. You know, it causes you pain, it causes other pain, because it goes against the natural order. Now, I could go against the natural order, and the creation will allow that, but it's not very comfortable. That's the difference between, you know, it's a papa. What we mean by papa, sin is kind of a Christian term. But when I go against the natural order, it creates pain. Papa are those behaviors which create pain for me and for others. You know? Punya are those karmas that do not create pain. They are comfortable. You know? They allow for the ananda, the wholeness that you are, to express in this creation. And so we always learn, even on a physical level, we continue to learn this natural order. I have learned that fire is hot and it's not good to put my hand in it. This is a Vedic example. I've learned by experience. So dharma, in terms of ethical behavior, we learn by experience. We learn the golden rule not because, you know, we naturally learn it by our experience. All the religions in the world are teaching that in one form or another. But they're not teaching something that is not innately taught to us by the nature of the creation. You know, we are in pain when we're not following it. It causes pain for myself and others.
And this order is obvious?
It's obvious if you pay attention. This is the learning behavior. Bhagavan, you know, you can take a lot of time to learn that. You know? Because your desires can be so strong that you don't want to face the facts of it. But you do learn. Some of us are slower learners. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's not even fair to say because of this. If you think of the creation as beginningless, we have been here for a long time. Say if you go forward a million years, it's still beginningless. You know, that's kind of, it's a nadi, what we call a nadi. That takes a, you know, we learn and we assimilate, you know, our experience slowly because raga and dvesha is so profound and the ajnana, the ignorance is so profound. You know? But if you look at, you know, religions are part, there's many, many different religions, many tribal religions, there's so many different religions that are, really, if you think about them, they may, in some ways, every religion has its shadow and all of that. And over time has become corrupted in this way or that way. But they're trying to carry a dharma, carry the dharma, you know, and teach the dharma. It's almost like saying, You know, this is what we've been taught. This is what works. Over a long period of time, these laws have stood the test of time. Even if you look at the Ten Commandments, you know, the ten, thou shalt not do this and thou shalt do that. But nobody's analyzed them. If you do these things, it causes a lot of trouble. It causes so many problems. So we've learned in life, don't do this. And don't do this and don't do this.
So it's not rocket science then?
Yeah, it's something that humanity has learned. You know, even if you look at the yamas and the niyamas and all of the different, you know, it doesn't matter. There things, certain things will work in life and certain things don't work in life. But the problem is, that's why Swamiji's Value of Values, the book Value of Values, is so beautiful. Because he's just looking at these dharmas that have been taught by all the religions over, you know, how many thousands and thousands of years. And he just takes them and looks at them in terms of, why is this? Why is this value important? Why is it to your best, in your best interest to follow this? And he just takes them one by one. The ones that are we're going to be going through in chapter 13, actually from about like verse 5 to 8 or 9. He goes through each one of these. Why is this value? Why should you value this value? Why is it in your best interest? And that type of clarity, that's knowledge, you know? Instead of just, my mother told me not to do this, you know, it doesn't go very far. There's a knowledge and assimilation that has to take place of why this is in my best interest. You know? And then that value becomes real for me. It sounds maybe self-centered, but we're all very self-centered. What we do is that which is in our best interest. Even following Dharma, even giving charity, all of the things that we really do because that is what is best for me, for my well-being. For my shanti. A person who's a dharmanishta, means they're committed to the following of Dharma, is not doing it because it makes them miserable. It's because of assimilation of experience, they realize that that practice of Dharma gives me a wholeness and a fullness and abiding shanti that the going against Dharma absolutely does not give. It's an assimilation of experience. You know, why do we spend all of this time, you know, studying Vedanta, you know, and exposing myself to this teaching? Why would I do it? Because it's in my best interest. That's why. There's nothing wrong in that. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you know, I think it's Yajnavalkya, I can't remember the name, which Rishi says what. But he says to his wife, you know, you love your child, you love your son for your own sake. You love your wealth for your own sake. You love your husband for your own sake. He goes on the whole list of everything. It's for your own ananda. Everything is for the sake of your own wholeness, for your own fullness. And if you think of it, when you really start recognizing, everything is... You say for the sake of yourself, but everything is for the sake of the self. The self. Everything. You know? And so, in samsara, we run around doing this and doing that, doing this and doing that, so that we can have an antakarna vritti, a mind that has enough shanti to reflect my being, so that I can feel at peace for the moment. Right? We run around doing whatever we can do to get a shantavritti. Because that's the shantavritti is the closest, as a samsari, I can come to myself. Right? Because say for instance I have a clean shiny mirror and I hold that clean shiny mirror up to the sun. Okay? That's a shantavritti. This clean, shiny mirror is reflecting the sun in a way that is true to the sun. It's not the sun, right? But it's totally resonant with the sun. And so it is doing just fine in reference to the sun. Whereas if it's cracked or broken or muddy, you know, then the sun in it isn't reflecting well. So for the antakarna, for the mind, when that shantavritti is there, it's almost invisible to my own being. And it reflects my being also. So I feel great. Now you'll even feel, this is who I am. This is what I'm supposed to be. This is how I'm supposed to be. You'll be talking like that because you're only that way some of the time. Because the mind has the shantavritti only some of the time. So when the shantavritti goes, I've gone. Okay? Because there's no viveka yet between the sun illumining the shantavritti, the self that is constant, and the state of mind. And so in samsara, we're running around trying to create the state of mind because that's the closest we can get to myself, even though I am always there, full and complete, illumining whatever vritti is there. But there's no viveka, so the mind is only focused on its own content, not the content that is stable. The content self is stable. It's never not there. It's I. But the only experience that I'm acknowledging as valid or even recognizing is whatever emotions are really there in the mind. That's all we really care about in a sense is emotions. Affect.
So it's actually a fixation of the mind in a certain way on the shantavritti instead of what's really underneath the shantavritti.
Yeah. When what's underneath or what's the very substance of any vritti is recognized, then the shantavritti or ashantavritti is not very important because they're all taking place in the shanti of the atma, but that viveka that's been discerned. You know, otherwise it's not discerned. It's always one and the same thing. So the shanti of the atma is always mixed with the ashanti of the vritti, right? I haven't recognized that the ashanti, the agitation, is taking place in shanti, the change of shanti of me. But as I recognize it, then my mind is soothed because it always has the change of shanti of me. It's never away from it. And so it starts becoming, falling in love, reveling in the source of the ananda. Instead of going in the circuitous route, let me get this so that I can have shantavritti, so that I can feel happy, but then this might go, and as this is threatening to go, shantavritti goes away, and then I have to get that back. It goes on and on, endlessly not working. Endlessly not working till you become a mumukshu who says, this is endlessly not working.
Well, is that why the presence...
That's the viveka.
Is that why the presence of me seems to disappear? Or?
It never disappears, but it's always shrouded by the emotion.
When it gets routed, there's no access there.
No, but see, when I say it gets shrouded, that's only for the aviveka, because your focus is on the emotion rather than the self in which the emotion takes place. There's no viveka there. Because in reality, your being is never shrouded. Just like, you know, the sun illuminating the clouds, right? The sun is not shrouded by the clouds from its own standpoint. Right? It's illuminating the clouds. It's not covered by the clouds. You think it's covered by the clouds by the one who's standing there on the ground. Oh, I can't see the sun. But the sun's not saying I can't see the sun. The sun is the sun. It's illuminating. Because of the sun, the clouds are illumined. But it takes, you are the sun. So now, it's the mind that has this problem. The mind has a cloudy emotion. Okay. And so the mind says, you know, I'm cloudy. Because it takes itself to be the conscious being, and now the conscious being is cloudy. But what we have to do is bring some viveka to that experience where you recognize the cloud is there, and I, the one who illumines the cloud, is also there.
Well, then it seems like the viveka seems to fluctuate. Sometimes it's, you know, it's spot on. You notice the presence. Other times you don't notice it.
Well, when you don't notice that, that's where there's some lack of clarity.
Lack of clarity or why would the viveka fluctuate?
I would say it fluctuates because of lack of clarity. In this particular situation, this situation is so important to me, mm-hmm. you know, that there is no viveka in operation.
Yeah.
Right? And so but what happens with that is when this overwhelm is taking place, all that's real for you at that time is whatever is the content of the overwhelm. Yeah. That's what's real.
Yeah.
But that will subside, just like a wave. It will subside, and then you'll say, wow, I was really overwhelmed. My knowledge was as though put to rest for the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when the overwhelm is gone, you're back. Your knowledge is back. Okay. There comes a time when the mind doesn't have that overwhelming capacity. Even when the mind is overwhelming, it doesn't overwhelm your knowledge. Your mind is overwhelmed, full of affect, doing this and doing that, going through all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But you are still there. Right? And then there's as the mind matures, these overwhelms slowly drop off. Sometimes there's a lot of unconscious material inside. There's a lot for us to work on there, you know. Sometimes the overwhelms come from unconscious material.
Should you comment on that about yourself, on those happenings?
When you can, you can do it after the fact or during. Like you can say something like, "It's okay. You're really overwhelmed." You can come in as the buddhi can come in as a good friend. If the overwhelm is so much that the buddhi is not even there for the time being, then afterwards you can say, it's okay, you're really overwhelmed. And just then bring yourself back to back home.
So, Radha, it's really a question of accommodating it then.
Accommodating and being
the welcomer of that.
Yeah, and being it with it in a way that is helpful.
So not like a way to get rid of it or something like that.
It's not
analyzing it.
You know, like getting rid of it is a rejection. It's not about rejecting, it's about understanding. And the understanding, you know, resolves it. Understanding is much different than getting rid of. So the understanding, with the understanding, it does resolve.
Because there's a natural tendency to try to get rid of this.
But when you're trying to get rid of it, there's violence in that.
Yeah.
Instead of care.
But there's also that intellectualizing it away is also violence then of some sort.
You know,
people get heady about that stuff.
There's different levels of care. Once the problem is not overwhelming, you can bring your mind back to your knowledge. You know? But I don't think that's heady. If you bring your mind back to your knowledge, you're bringing your mind back to what you know, the reality of your being, you know, the reality to Ishwara, to your own being. But there's different times where different aid is needed. Like you're not going to tell the little child inside, don't worry, you're Brahman. The little child doesn't need that, you know. It needs some other level of care.
But it is a process of caring.
It's all a process of caring. But see, your knowledge comes into the care. Even the one who's taking care of the little child inside is the buddhi that has knowledge, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't mean that you're giving the little child knowledge, but the buddhi has knowledge, you know. It knows who you are. But that doesn't mean it's appropriate to be dealing in that way with a hurt. You deal with it on all different levels, the level that's...
So you should be great, even having that kind of mind that gets lost. There should still be a gratefulness of having a mind that's able to do that, or
If you have that gratefulness, that's a beautiful thing. That's a wonderful thing to have. That gratitude to Bhagavan. That's the prasad de buddhi. Mm. You know?
It's actually interesting what you're saying, you know. I was just thinking this analogy with a child and the parent, that works really good between the buddhi and the mind. Because there are also different levels of the buddhi in terms of skill sets that the parent can bring to a situation with a child. And they can be either refined or less refined. And it creates a totally different outcome. And so it's just totally applies to what we were saying.
Yeah, to understanding, some knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
The way you handle with your own mind and your own
But then if you could have gratitude, then you wouldn't have to go through all that time stuff.
With all the what stuff?
Then you wouldn't have to go through all that work if you can have gratitude.
Yeah, but no. That's what, yeah, in the end
you
have
the grace of gratitude.
Yeah.
Then the story's over. Right?
Can be. Yes. Actually, I think that's true. Like, yes. Because then when that's there, then you really have full possession of your buddhi. and then the little ones, and the traumas and things that are happening, has someone who's really caring, can really take care of it at that time. So, you know, sometimes you have to be patient. With the overwhelm is overwhelming everything.
Yeah, and you just write, you say, okay, you have to write it up.
We'll write it up. But there's a buddhi right there.
Yeah, right.
The buddhi is saying, okay, I'll ride this out. Sometimes that one isn't even there.
Pardon me?
Sometimes that one that says, okay, this is overwhelming, we'll just write, it'll come to an end. That one isn't even there to say that. You get lost in your... totally lost in your emotion, but that too will come to an end, and then you can say that something, because the buddhi is back. Right? When that happens, that's when you're totally immersed in the tidal wave, in the tidal wave of your unconscious.
Somebody said, if it takes up the whole screen.
Yeah, if it takes up the whole screen, you have to wait for the water to subside a little bit. But you learn, these are all skills, you know. It's what in Krishna calls kaushalam, that skill,
yeah.
Knowledge and being able to handle.
That's why you always say to be patient.
Yeah.
You say that a lot.
Yeah. Patience is very kind. You know, it's a kind thing, kind to be patient.
Oh, my mother was very patient.
She loved you.
What is kaushalyam, just skill?
Yeah, skill, like skill in action, but it's you know, being able to have some viveka, bring dharma into the situation, or to know how to handle a situation in a way that's helpful. So, like, it's kaushalyam, how to handle your mind, how to handle your unconscious, how to handle the traumas and the overwhelms. That's a skill. It's a knowledge.
That's like psychology in a certain way, all about, right?
Yeah.
You could say,
yeah,
isn't it?
But kaushalam, that's applied in so many different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
It's an understanding of how to handle the situation, whatever it may be, in a way that is helpful and useful. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop. Yeah. Mm-hmm.